51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. To film now, three movies up for review this week. The Amazing Spider-Man 2, starring Andrew Garfield, as the webbed wonder. The Sea, John Banville's adaptation of his own Man Booker Prize-winning novel. And We Are the Best, a tale of 80s punk from Swedish director Lukas Moodysson. Simon Marr, Roe McDermott have been to see the films for us. They're with me in studio this evening. Simon, we'll start with The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and just remind us of how and when this current incarnation, directed by Mark Webb, suitably named, and with Garfield as Spider-Man, when did it begin and what are their plans?
Right, we're now, this is film two in the latest reboot. So The Amazing Spider-Man was only 2 years ago, and the previous version of the previous Super Spider-Man reboot wasn't too far before that. But where this one takes us back to is we're really into franchise area. The first one was really a long trailer for a series of 10 of these, apparently, that are to come. Number two, we're now into slightly more firmer territory where there's some semblance of a plot. We're starting to introduce some logic, with logic as much as it can be in a Marvel series, of villains and a story and a backstory. And that's where we're going from here. So we've got a relatively young Peter Parker slash Spider-Man, and he's now getting into the role of being Spider-Man.
And I suppose the bit that the backstory that we got most of in the first film and that's carried through here is the relationship with Gwen Stacy, played by Emma Stone. Role.
Yeah, it is. And I think there is a slight problem with Spider-Man in that his origin story is the most interesting thing about him. Because when you look at his villains, I mean, for a story that's based on being bitten by a radioactive spider, Spider-Man as a character and as a franchise and as an entity of itself, it's really anti-technology. Mm. All of his villains seem to be mutated by corporate greed combined with advanced technology. And so again, we see that here, but it is, there's also a beautiful love story at the heart of it, because you see this relationship with Gwen Stacy, who was his high school love, and she's accepted the fact that he's Spider-Man, and they're kind of navigating this dual role that he has. And
but he has to keep a promise to Gwen's dead father.
Gwen's dead father, yeah, that sounds as melodramatic as it was in the first one. It was perhaps the longest death scene I've ever seen in the first one. But yeah, he promised Gwen Stacy's father that he would keep her safe, but he's struggling because of the guilt of allowing her father to die, the desire to keep her safe, and of course the desire to be around her.
And he promised her too that he'd stay away from her as well as keep her safe.
Yeah, which results in him stalking her a lot from on high. I mean, Spider-Man is he really wouldn't work if he was in a small town filled with bungalows, really, would he?
No. Gotta be tall buildings above.
All right, well, let's hear a little bit with Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield struggling through their stay away from and mind me type relationship.
I promised him that I would keep away from you, and now I'm gonna come and eat dinner with your family. How can I do this? What does this make me?
I don't know. What does that make you?
It makes me not able to live with myself.
I thought that it meant you loved me.
I do love you. I love you.
And why isn't that enough? Huh?
Because what if something happens to you just like it happened to him because of me? Okay. No, wait.
Listen,
wait.
No,
wait. I cannot let that happen.
Listen to me. You're Spider-Man. But I love that. But I love Peter Parker more. That's worth it to me.
I can't lose you, too.
Because you can't lose me. We can't be together. Who does that work out for, Peter?
I can't. I'm sorry, Gwen.
Wow. You have done this to me again and again, Peter. I can't live like this. I break up with you.
Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield going out together in real life, from both of you, does the chemistry in real life transfer onto the screen?
Absolutely, oh, yeah.
They're absolutely adorable. And that's quite a cheesy clip, I have to say. And there's a lot of really witty, sly banter between them, which is really, really adorable.
However, love story is one part of an action hero. Well, it's usually a small part. The bit that we all want to know about, I think, are the villains. Yeah, there are several of them.
There are several of them. Probably the Green Goblin and Electro. Electro is probably the main villain, played by Jamie Foxx. And Electro gets the mutation from, I think it's Oscorp is the name of it. He gets hit by electricity, and which is can happen to anybody, which develops the amazing superpower of
electricity. He's quite nerdish before this.
He is. No, he is a very nerdish sort of a character, and he turns, maybe this is something that happens when you become mutated, he seems to turn very, very quickly against Spider-Man. So he doesn't seem to have any particular problem with Peter Parker beforehand, gets hit by electricity, and now he hates him.
All right. Well, let's hear Jamie Foxx as Max Dillon is the character who then becomes, what did you say? His
Electro.
Electro. And here are the two of them, I think, having a bit of a contretemps on Times Square.
No sparkles. Hey, how you doing?
Is you?
Yeah, I know it's me. Who are you?
You don't remember me.
No? Did I?
I walked into the street. The car almost hit me. You swooped me up. You saved me. You said you needed me.
The guy, you're the guy with the blueprints.
Yes. Blueprints.
Yes, I remember you. Of course I remember you. You have my eyes and ears. What's your name again?
How could you forget me?
Oh, I do. I know it. I know it. Don't tell me.
It's Max.
Is it Max?
Yes.
I'm sorry I didn't recognize you with the... You look different. How are you?
I don't know what's going on with me.
I can see that. I believe you.
Strange. But I feel I got so much... I got so much anger.
Oh, a lot of anger from Max Dillon stroke Electro, played by Jamie Foxx. Funny bassoon music going on underneath there from Hans Zimmer, Row.
The score is utterly insane in this film. And genuinely, it is completely schizophrenic because that bassoon music and this woodwind orchestral sound suddenly explodes into heavy metal whenever Electro begins attacking Times Square. But then it goes into very sentimental, pure, almost period drama piece around the romance. And then you have these pandering pop songs, and it is relentless. I'm struggling to remember any scene where there wasn't a blaring soundtrack, right, and it becomes quite distracting.
Pharrell Williams and Johnny Marr involved in the soundtrack as well.
Yeah.
Now, the other bit is the action. He flies everywhere. Those scenes I remember from the first movie were quite spectacular. Do they still hold the attention in this one?
In fairness, I think they actually worked better in this. There was something that just didn't feel quite right about it the first time around, but this time, and maybe because they know they're designing a film for IMAX 3D, Superscope, whatever it is, so that they have to look spectacular. Mm. But it means that everywhere, even if he's just going for a pint of milk, he will swoop from a very great height no matter what he's doing.
Well, you would if you could.
Oh, so would I, absolutely.
And briefly, the other villain that we start to meet in this is Harry Osborn, played by Dane DeHaan. Is he really going to be developed as the franchise goes on?
I mean, and it's set up that there's a beginning of a rivalry between himself, and himself and Peter Parker were childhood friends, and he has just seen the death of his father, and they kind of bond over that because Peter Parker is, of course, an orphan. But he will be set up, and he's an interesting character because Dane DeHaan is very good at playing both vulnerable and sleazy and sinister. So he's going to be an interesting one to watch. He's a lot more interesting than Electro.
All right. What is going to happen then here? Are you going to manage to stay with it up until Spider-Man, The Amazing Spider-Man 10 will still be amazing at that point? 2 hours and 12 minutes or 22 minutes on this one?
It's a bit bloated. I think the strengths of this are Andrew Garfield, and he's what's going to ground this entire franchise because he's a brilliant actor and he brings the sensitivity to Peter Parker and also a bit of arrogant swagger of a teenager who has just realised that he is powerful. So I think he's great. So I think as long as he stays with the franchise, I'll be interested. But they really need to get more interesting villains.
And stars out of five, Ro?
I'm going to give 3.5. The romance is great, but Electro just really bored me.
And Emma Stone's character more than just a tokenistic then, yeah?
She was brilliant, and Shailene Woodley is up for the romantic interest in the next one, so she should do it as well.
And Simon, from you, overall?
I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5, but I do want them to just push it on a bit, and I'm with Ro totally on the villains.
Let us move on to film number 2 then, The Sea, Irish author John Banville's adaptation of his own Man Booker Prize winning novel. Ciarán Hinds plays the lead role of Max. Tell us about that character and sort of the three stories that he's telling, Ro.
Yeah, Max is an art historian who is recovering after the death of his wife, who is played brilliantly by Sinead Cusack. And he returns to this Irish coastal town where he grew up. And this appears to be an exercise in both kind of masochism and desperation, because this fragile widower, he's confronted with the memories of his past, and obviously as the film goes on you begin
and it's the distant past as well as his wife's recent death.
Yeah, and he's kind of exploring this childhood trauma that happens, that unfolds very slowly, but he's also faced with the adult version of somebody from that story, and the relationship is unclear to the audience until the very end of the film. So he's kind of confronted with trying to be polite in the face of this figure from his past, remembering this traumatic event, and of course grieving his wife.
Well, here's at the moment when Max, played by Ciarán Hinds, returns to this home, which is now a hostel, and the first person he meets is the landlady, played by Charlotte Rampling.
Hello. I'm...
Yes.
You remember me?
Of course. Come in.
Thank you.
Please come this way.
I can't find the bloody thing.
So what we got there was he arrives back in the present moment, and then there's that flashback to clearly something awful that happened in that childhood story. How are the three time frames worked out for us when we're looking at the film? Is it easy to follow in that respect?
I think
Simon?
It is. It's one of the things that could have really tripped up something like this. That works. It's kind of very easy for it to work in a book, but when you try then to bring it to a movie, you risk horribly overcomplicating it. But what they do with this, and it's the one thing I suppose Stephen Brown deserves a lot of credit for, is that
he's a first-time director.
Yeah,
Stephen
the jumping
Brown.
Around between the three works very, very well. But what tends to happen is because they're so fixated on making sure you don't get lost in the three time jumps, it sort of constricts the film very much, because it's okay, look, we could really push this, but it's just going to confuse people, so they tend to keep it a little bit too structured.
But the colours are basically different from time frame to time frame.
They are, and they do work, like emotionally they're very reflective of what's going on, because in the present it's very blue and grey and all the seas are heightened in this very kind of cold palette, but it kind of emphasises this grief and this despair that's washing over Max. And then when they look back to 1955, it's all gold saturated, and it's kind of this element of the innocence of youth and the heat of the summer, but also the heat of sexual awakening, which becomes a huge part of that storyline. So they do look very different, and they kind of evoke this sense of, you know, the gold saturation. It's this trick of a memory almost, and it kind of plays on the element that memory changes on you and it's idealised,
which again is easier to do in a book than it is in a film.
Yeah.
What about the performances here, because a lot of it will rest on those, I guess.
Well, I think Ciarán Hinds is very good. Like, he's a very, very solid actor, and he plays the part well without utterly having to reveal himself. You know, even in the scenes that Ro mentioned with Sinead Cusack, you get the feeling that she may not necessarily be his biggest fan anyway, regardless of what is going on in his life. So he does play that well, and he plays the post Sinead Cusack character very well. Some of the others, I thought Charlotte Rampling was very, very good in it as well.
That's the landlady character.
Yes,
yeah.
I think she does very well in it too. But a lot of the others, they're great and they put in a decent shift, but there's nothing particularly remarkable.
This is it's the family back, the childhood family. Rufus Sewell plays the dad, Natasha Michael Hone plays the mum, and Missy Keating, who plays the little girl with whom he has this sort of frisson.
Yeah, and she kind of plays this young Estella type character in that she's quite cold to him and often mean, but she becomes this kind of figment of sexual awakening and first love. Yeah, absolutely. I actually find her interesting because she kind of captures how kids can be cruel to each other and the kind of power dynamic that she realises she has a hold on him and then starts to play on it. So I found her interesting. So I think she might be one to watch. But I found that the dramatic climax of that storyline in particular, because the film has a very languid and almost kind of indulgent pacing to it, but it lets down the dramatic scenes.
All right, notoriously difficult, and a Man Booker Prize winning novel, notoriously even more difficult perhaps to adapt that for the screen. Does this work overall, and if not, where not?
It's funny because it's only 86, 87 minutes long, so it's quite a short, so it doesn't go out of its way to indulge itself, but as we mentioned, the pacing of it still makes it feel that bit indulgent, and I'm not sure the transfer is worth. And I think I would be in a similar position if I was John Banville and I had to write the screenplay to my novel. I think I would possibly have been this sort of, it seems he's been slightly precious with it, and that's absolutely fair enough, and perhaps that's what makes it not quite make the transition.
Stars?
I'm going to give it 2.5.
And from you, Ro?
2.5 as well. It feels there's interesting stuff there, but it is kind of painfully middlebrow, which, to be fair, you'd expect from a Banville adaptation.
He said that about the novel himself, didn't he? Way back when he won the Man Booker Prize, maybe coming back to haunt him now. Finally, tonight you've been to see We Are the Best, a Swedish film. Three teenage girls set out to form a punk band. Who are these three teenage girls, and what are they? Why did they start the band?
This is just amazing stuff. It's a coming of age, but story of kids who don't fit in. You know, it starts off, the very first scene is they're at one of the kids' mum's 40th birthday party. And the rather than wanting to stay up for the party, he just wants to get away from all of these adults and go to bed. And then they go and they have to go to a gym scene and they're being asked to play basketball. And it's like, we just don't want to do this. We hate sport. We hate everything about all of the people that are around us. So our refuge is punk.
And you're going to rebel. Lucas Moodyson is the director here. We spoke to, of this film. We spoke to him on the programme a couple of weeks back. What would we know him from, and where does this fit into that overall body of work, would you say, Ro?
He's done some interesting films. The last one he had was Mammoth, which starred Michelle Williams, and it felt like it was trying to be a kind of Blue Valentine artsy romance. And I feel like this is actually an adaptation of his wife's graphic novel.
His wife, Coco, and one of the characters is called Bobo. I
yes.
wonder who she is.
And I feel like that element of a personal attachment is so evident here, and just the emotions and the performances, and he really captures that sense of innocence. Young girls trying to be precocious and trying to latch on to something that will give them meaning, and it feels so much more authentic than his other work.
It rests on the three centre performances from the three young teenage girls.
Yes.
I don't know whether they're possibly in their 20s playing down a bit. How do they fare?
I think the three of them are amazing. They're two of them, Mira, I think, yeah. Two of them are called, yeah. Mira, and then they bring in another girl called Hedvig, and Hedvig is this sort of Christian acoustic Aaron Jumper wearing, you know, goody who doesn't last long, as that soon gets drawn in
with long blonde hair
with
at the
long
beginning.
Blonde hair at the hair, but definitely not with
cropped blonde hair at the end.
With punk hair as it goes on, and she is the perfect foil for them, you know, because she just gets in, and like when you go and see a film like this, she buys into it immediately, and because she buys into it, everybody buys into
it. They say that this is Moodyson returning to form.
Yeah, it absolutely is, because I mean, I think he went on, he's always had this beautiful glow of compassion in all of his works, but he kind of got distracted by elements of globalization and his other dramas, and it took away from the emotion. But here, it's just capturing this element of teenagers who want to combat things like nuclear power and the existence of God, but they also get really jealous when a boy pays attention to one of them, and it's just so heartfelt.
Stars?
4 out of 5 for me. I thought the music was like lovely and a disaster at the specific points, and it's just the performances are amazing.
Simon?
It's everything that punk should be, so I'm going to give it 4.5 out of 5.
10 seconds, Row, on Love Punch, which you've been to see. Joel Hopkins directing, Emma Thompson and Pierce Brosnan as a divorced couple trying to recover the retirement money they lost.
Yeah, Joel Hopkins directed Last Chance Harvey, and he has this brilliant way of taking Emma Thompson and putting her in these tedium inducing films. He's obviously aiming for a mature audience with, you know, a mature cast, but he just mistakes kind of accessible humour for really lazy humour, and he takes these actors who are innately funny and charismatic and just puts this really bland, boring plot onto them. I mean, if you take Emma Thompson, who is innately so witty and so flirtatious and crazy, and you put her in a relationship with Pierce Brosnan where they're meant to be this bitingly divorced couple, and they just turn it into something dull, it's just not worth the time. Really,
are you
not
going to give it any stars or an Easter egg of any
like
kind?
2, because I enjoy watching Emma Thompson do anything, but it's just bland. It takes this boring couple who want to go on to a heist, and it doesn't work as anything.
All right, well, Love Punch, Spider-Man 2 and The Sea are all on general release in cinemas from tomorrow, and the other film that Ro and Simon were talking to us about, We Are The Best, is at selected cinemas from tomorrow. And you can listen back to our interview with Lucas Moodyson talking to me here on Arena, funnily enough, on the April the 1st, but that is no joke, that's when he was in rte.ie/radio1/arena.